I don't know. I like your story. I like your narrative. But at the same time, the publisher was like, all of the people that read books are dead. Right. And the Bible is plateaued in sales. Hi, I'm Casey.
I'm Amy.
And this is Shipwreck.
Yay, Shipwreck.
Did you, I pictured like a little firecracker going off and like some confetti coming down.
Kabloomy.
So if you got confetti in your car listening to that, or your bus, or your ear.
Your what have yous. You know, your treadmills.
However you move about. This, we're dangerously close to contemporary. Like we're so close right now. We're only talking about 2 months ago?
Two actual shows ago. That's where we are.
Not even 2 months ago.
Yeah. It's kind of, it was touch and go. We weren't sure we would ever get here, but here we are. We are so excited. I'm excited.
Yeah, no, I think it's incredible. And what a place to be.
Yeah.
With Little Women. This is Little Women, right?
Yeah, and you know what? So it's a little sick because we kind of vaguely chose Little Women because of Mother's Day. I don't know. The show was like the Thursday before Mother's Day, and we were like, we need a Mother's Day book, which why would we ever think that?
But it's the most... Why would we think that?
I don't know. I remember having that conversation, though, that we were like, oh, it'll be Mother's Day. What perfect timing.
I think this is because we both work in editorial.
Yeah.
And we're thinking in terms of, oh, we got to peg it to something.
Always yeah.
Peg it. Mm-hmm. You got to peg it. Here's your St. Patrick's Day book. Right. Here's your Christmas book. But that's dumb.
Well, it's not that it's dumb, because a lot of times it works out. Next month it really worked out. But for this one, we were maybe a little misguided, I think. I think we maybe should have thought about this for an extra 10 seconds before deciding that this was a good idea.
Mother's Day kerfuffle aside, like the fact that you might share this with your mother aside.
Yeah.
This book is probably the most earnest, loving book that's ever been written. It has no conflict.
This is true.
It has nothing but people hugging. And occasionally, like, a sibling rivalry.
And, like, some embroidery.
No, sibling rivalry that lasts for, like, five pages.
That lasts for, like, five pages, and then everybody's fine again.
Even your least favorite character turns out to be fine.
Yeah, it's true. Nobody's even... Everyone's just, like, a tiny bit unlikable for a second, and then they're fine.
Yeah.
And then it turns out, actually, there's something to love in everybody.
Oh, it turned out you were six.
It turned out you were six. That's so true. Oh, it turns out you were not being a dick. You were just being six.
So, Little Women...
Yeah, so I was so excited to do this book when I first started reading it because it's like, it was this book that was like requested. I feel like I have to say this because I feel like I have to defend some aspect of this book because a lot of people really like it. But we were so excited to do it because, you know, it was commissioned by her publisher like right after the Civil War when all the men were dead and all of the women were alone and had nothing better to do. And they wanted this quiet little entertainment about women's lives. And I thought, wow, that's like... really cool. Like publishing got a little ahead of itself there. It was a good move. And then I read the book. And like we both, I think, did you listen to the audiobook?
I did. No, I read it and listened to the audiobook. I did both.
Yeah. I listened to the audiobook at work and I almost made it through, but I had to stop because the audiobook is recorded for children. So it's the same person doing different voices for all the characters. And it nearly drove me insane.
That's why you're better off reading books.
Yeah. Obviously. Always.
Generally speaking.
As a bookseller, I appreciate you saying that. All right, so we don't have to explain the show. We're not doing that anymore. What is the show? And
no, I think we're good.
We're good on that, right? Okay, great. So first up, we got Sally Gardner, right? There are four March sisters. Meg is the oldest, and Sally Gardner is Meg's best friend slash kind of like frenemy person. Sally is richer. She's prettier. She's better at flirting. She eventually marries the dude who was originally interested in Meg, but don't worry, they stay friends forever anyway. Riveting.
Everybody take a deep riveting. Breath. Let it on, go, oh yeah. Thank you. Sally Gardner and the Four Servants. The trouble began shortly after the wedding. And like so much of the trouble that besets honest women, its cause was idleness. Sally Moffat had simply nothing to do in the home. Her four maids kept house and hearth with a terrible efficiency, and Sally found life desperately dull. Her experience with her former servants had been quite different. The comforting features of John often greeted her over morning coffee. Each afternoon, she saw Paul chopping firewood in the yard. Every evening, George would gently massage her tits after a long day, drawing on lace shawls. And each night, Ringo hiked up her skirts and kissed her deeply, affectingly, on her womanly hillock as she drifted off to sleep. She missed Ringo most of all. But the servants in Ned's home were strangers to her. Four women with identical stern expressions. Without the intimacy that had characterized Sally's former domestic relations, the house was a barren place. For want of honest work, her hands found their way into wicked sinfulness. Her attempts to cook were as sincere as they were ill-fated. She was always pouring salt onto the berries instead of sugar, or over-churning the butter, or exploding TV dinners in her highly anachronistic microwave. And the servants were always laughing at her. Nor did she possess much skill in that most intimate of marital tasks, laundry. Or only slightly less important, butt stuff. A duty which, for Ned, required patience, imagination, and dexterity. Sometimes Sally suspected that there was more than excess of patriotism at play in Ned's desire to have her pound a wooden effigy of Abraham Lincoln into his gentleman's redoubt. As he wrapped himself in a flag of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and sang, John Brown's body is a-taking it up the ass. But she was a dutiful wife and did her best to be a true and loving helpmeet. And yet, every night, Ned seized his prideful bowsprit from out of her fumbling hands and caused it to spill forth his gentleman's gravy. Sally felt like a failure. The cutting mockery of the servants compounded her shame. One Sunday afternoon, she eavesdropped upon two of them as they cleaned the great dining room. Miss knows her way around an asshole no better than she does around the kitchen, Sally said. And both chortled. Sally withdrew to her room. Was this to be forever her fate? Mistress of the house only in name, useless to her husband, mocked by her servants? She wept bitter tears. But after an hour of such distress had passed, she found her breast swollen and her spirit ennobled, if you know what I mean. With a new and steely resolve, she was the mistress of the house. She would not be treated this way. At dinner, she was the image of perfect refinement. She nodded graciously as the servants brought out the meal, and again as they took it away. Afterwards, she escorted Ned to the marital bed and did her wifely duty there as well. Then, when her husband was sound asleep and snoring, she made her way downstairs. Ever so quietly, she sought the servants' quarters. Sally's stocking feet crept over the thick carpet in silence. As she approached the small servant's parlor, she saw that the lights remained lit within, and from the chamber of the conversation, she could tell that all of the servants were awake. She meant for her knock on the door to be imperious, but it came out timid and retiring. Still, a conversation within ceased at once. A moment later, Anna answered the door. She was the tallest of the servants and the ringleader. Yes, ma'am, she said. Said Sally. I want to have a word with you. Come in, ma'am. Sally entered. The other servants, Susanna, Savannah, and Hannah Montana, were seated around a low table. They did not rise to greet her. Sally was stunned and speechless by their insolence. Anna nudged her. A word, ma'am? Oh, Sally said. Yes, right, I think you all oughtn't be so mean to me. She punctuated this weak-willed utterance with a failed attempt at a firm nod. Why, we're not mean to you at all, said Savannah. But you're always laughing at me, cried Sally petulantly. That's just because you're an embarrassing incompetent, said her voice was frank and kind, and all of the other women nodded firmly but gently. Sally found herself on the edge of tears once more. It's true, she said. Oh, how true it is! Anna put a kindly hand on Sally's shoulder. We can teach you, ma'am, if that is what you want, and if you're willing to learn. Oh, I must learn, said Sally. I must learn to be useful, but how can I? She gazed earnestly into the other women's eyes, seeing into her very soul. She got a little wet. Not, you know, a lot, but a little. We must put you to the test, said Anna. I accept, Sally whispered. At once, she found herself in the scandalous grip of her servant's hands. And of passion! Her womanly crevice grew as slick and as well-oiled as a carriage axle. Susanna seized her arms while Savannah and Hannah Montana, her eyes apart, her legs. Anna retired briefly into the kitchen and returned with the butter churn staff, hefting it menacingly in both hands. Mistress is always over-churning the butter, isn't she? The three servants holding Sally in place nodded. We'll show her how to churn the butter just right. With a single imperious gesture, Anna flung aside Sally's underthings. They landed in the fire, where they began to smolder alarmingly. But that's not all that was alarmingly smoldering. Sorry. Anna's grin grew wickeder and wider as she pressed the head of the matter upon Sally and then into her. Sally began to exude that clarified bitty butter that is the birthright of every woman. At first, it was the merest shimmer, but soon it trebled in volume, growing wet and sloppy. Working the churn expertly, Anna contrived to return the greater portion of it to the spring whence it came, which only heightened Sally's ardor. She began to heave herself into the shaft, writhing in the arms of the other women. Sally cried out softly at first, and then a greater and greater volume. Churn me! Churn me! Oh, Anna, churn me, goddammit! Anna, despite her unusual position, betook herself to heed her mistress's words, working even more vigorously upon her. Her strokes took up a grander scope and character, removing themselves entirely from their object and then plunging once more upon it. The gases thus compressed made their way out of the tight seal formed between Sally and the churn sack, like a proud, ill-tutored trumpet. Herself moaning with ecstasy. And still, Anna pounded her. Still, her other three servants held her in an inescapable grasp. When her climax came, it was like that of a pulp novel, long foreshadowed and arriving in high dudgeon with a naked lady and some other ladies. Sally screamed. She moaned. She bellowed like a bull, huffed like a steroid-riddled bodybuilder trying to max a squat. And when she came to from the utmost exertion, she found Anna tenderly wiping her brow. The first lesson is thus concluded, ma'am, Anna said. Well, replied Sally, with the last iota of strength in her parched lips. There must certainly be another. The end.
That was Sally Gardner, as imagined by Lewis Evans, longtime booster for the program.
I love that guy.
He's a pretty nice guy.
Yeah, he's pretty great.
He gives me a high five every time I see him.
He's a really good high fiver.
And I see him all the time.
I want to say that on record. Lewis Evans is a really good high fiver.
Like, better than me. I've had to up my game.
Yeah.
I have a high five dummy at the house that I just high five with.
You just practice on? Kind of like a punching bag, but it's actually just like a disembodied fist.
Every time I miss it, a recorded voice yells, "Look at the elbow!"
Marmee is the absolutely perfect sainted mother. She is the very definition of long-suffering, morals and scruples and whatever, whatever. But for most of the book, her husband is away doing whatever it is that men do, dying in the Civil War. I think he comes back, though.
What was he doing there? He's like a doctor or a priest. He was a minister.
That sounds right.
Is that what they call it?
Anyway, look, the point is, if this were real fan fiction about the actual person in the actual book, it would be about how perfectly chaste and non-masturbatory Marmee is during her entire husband's absence, because that's literally something that I think this book would consider a plotline.
Oh, God, yeah, they would. Like, it would just be her kind of sideline staring at a book of...
And, like, sewing.
Yeah. like a picture of her husband and sewing angrily.
Yeah. That's it.
This story is called Marmee's Gifts. Birthdays wouldn't be birthdays without any presents. Despite the loss of their fortune, Marmee was determined that her girls should know all the pleasures of life. The year Meg turned 18, Marmee gave her a bottle of homemade lubricant. When Joe's turn came, she received a writing whip from her mother's hand. In my own struggle to maintain a sweet, womanly disposition, I have found a regular occasion to exercise my anger in a safe and consensual manner to be invaluable, Marmee told Joe, stroking her bounteous hair. Beth was given an instrument of self-pleasure, so she might not suffer from her shyness. For Amy, a beautiful white leather collar and leash trimmed in blue velvet with matching clamps. For the nipples and privy parts. For Marmee knew that her proud youngest daughter secretly craved a little humiliation. With each gift, the receiver turned to Marmee with wide eyes and questions, and after all had been answered, kissed her sweetly in thanks. For who knew a woman's inner desires better than her mother? One special birthday of her own, Mrs. March was sewing in a room. Her diligent labor and her musings about whether to allow or not allow Mr. March to come that evening was disturbed by a knock on the door. Come in, Marmee called, and instantly forgave the interruption because in came Laurie, looking naughty. Ma'am, said he with a little bow, I am here to soften the ground, or one might say, to wet the whistle. In short, I have been given the most pleasurable task of preparing you for a celebration, and I will not take no for an answer. Mrs. March would not have dreamed of saying no to her dear boy, and gave him to understand she was amenable to whatever he proposed. Laurie wasted no time in shedding all of his clothes. Marmee ran a critical eye over his young body, pleased with the developed muscles of his thighs, his round ass, and his sizable cock, which was even now swelling to life under her motherly eyes. I'm at your disposal, ma'am, Laurie announced, flinging his arms wide. Marmee nodded and set aside her sewing. Right away, said she. Laurie began by relieving Mrs. March of her underclothing. When her pussy was fully exposed beneath her petticoats, she settled on the edge of her armchair, and Laurie dove in, licking and sucking at her cunt with all the enthusiasm of a youth. Mrs. March sighed in pleasure and allowed her eyes to drift shut, relieving all the glorious pussy lickings of her life. Margaret Fuller, being the undisputed champion, God rest her soul. As Laurie did his manful best to please her, Marmee sunk her hand into his curly hair and showed him, through action more than word, how best to carry on, tugging sharply when he missed the mark, caressing when his tongue alighted on the perfect spot to make her quiver with pleasure. As her climax grew near her, Marmee instructed Laurie on how to find her G-spot. encouraging him to put three fingers inside of her and curl them just so. Yes, she came in a gush of moisture that would have put a younger woman to shame. As Laurie rose, Mrs. March eyed his bobbing cock with excitement. She could not decide if she would rather have it in her mouth or pussy first. But Laurie informed her that they were expected elsewhere, though he was as eager to continue as she. Laurie dressed hastily, and they hurried out the door. The party was to be held at the Emerson House. When they arrived, all of Marnie's loved ones were waiting in the drawing room. Joe was the most impatient to begin, taking Laurie by the ear and demanding, "Teddy, did you prepare her properly like a good boy?" "I did my level best," he exclaimed. "See for yourself." As soon as Marmy's skirts were lifted, they could all see what a fine job he had done. For her thighs were wet with the evidence. All the girls helped to disrobe Marmy, petting and licking her neck, her wide nipples, and finally, her dripping cunt. As the host, Mr. Emerson, had the honor of the first dance, exclaiming as he sunk into her pussy, "The age of a woman doesn't mean a thing. The best tunes are played on the oldest fiddles." While Mrs. March... It's true. While Mrs. March could not in all honesty claim that the oldest bows were always best, she nevertheless enjoyed his efforts to play a jaunty tune. Soon enough, Emerson finished crying, "The reward of a thing well done is to have done it." As he filled her with spunk. And Laurie got a second chance, this time joined by Joe, who finally had her fondest wish fulfilled when she strapped on a cock of her very own. "Mothers are the best lovers," Joe cried as she thrust her marble cock up into her mother's slippery cunt. Marnie rewarded her with a tender kiss, thrusting her tongue into her daughter's mouth in rhythm to Joe's thrusts. Laurie settled behind Marnie and began lubricating her delicate rosebud. Mrs. March knew that Laurie's gaze was all for her daughter as he slowly inched his way inside her ass, but she did not mind. The poor boy would learn that the only way he would ever have her sweet Joe was if he was willing to let Joe fuck him, just as he was currently fucking Marmy. And now he would enjoy that day, if ever it came to pass. Marmy thought before all coherent thought was banished by the absolute fulfillment of being possessed front and back by her dear children. Had she been able to open her eyes, she would have been pleased to see the amusement all around her. Dear old Mr. Lawrence bouncing Beth upon his lap, Mr. March demonstrating his teaching techniques to an eager Elizabeth Peabody, and Meg tonguing Amy's nipple clamps while John fucked her from behind. But for the moment, Marmy allowed herself to selfishly revel in her own joy. What a blessed life it was to love and be loved. What pleasures were to be found in the simple goodness of family life.
That was Marmy, as written by Ferocity Prose. Ferocity Prose.
That's like maybe the best pseudonym that anyone has ever come up with for our show.
Since it's a pseudonym, that means it's not taken, and I'm considering registering that as my new real name.
Yeah, I think you should. I think that's a great idea. All right, Beth. Beth she has kind of a tragic story arc. It's very sad. Get your tissues. She's the second youngest March sister, and she has no attributes or hobbies or traits, except that she thinks about God and heaven a lot, which should pretty much immediately clue you in that she's going to have a terrible story arc, which she does. She also has this doll collection that she's super into, and, you know, like a lot of dolls from the 1860s are super creepy, super creepy, which means, and this is true, that dolls from the 1860s have exactly one more character trait than Beth March.
All right. More sex. This one is called Felt.
Oh my god.
hospital for neglected dolls was a hat box on a thrash heap behind the burning barrel. Dark smoke befouled the air with the soot of shit and corn cobs, which the March family, like most Civil War era Americans, used for toilet paper. You can Google it. Blacker than the corn cob soot was the mood of the dolls that day. There were 6 dolls, 5 of them cast-offs from the older March sisters. Lavender Lawrence had once just been Lavender, until a butter-churning accident tore her skirt. Respecting the fluidity of gender, Beth cut the doll's hair and sewed the skirt into a pair of purple culottes. Any dandy could envy those culottes. Uneven Pete lost a leg to a rabbit cat, so Beth replaced it with a matchstick and made him talk like a pirate. Sally No Face had no face. And Greta's skin had lost her stuffing entirely. Only one doll, Joanna, was completely intact. So Beth declared her a paralytic. She built a toothpick wheelchair and piled it high with blanket scraps to keep Joanna comfortable. The 6th doll was the finger bone of a dead gypsy. Beth fed and clothed her dolls daily, nursed them and sang to them, made certain no act of neglect would ever sadden their hearts. When it rained, she fashioned them tiny umbrellas. When the sun shone, she took them tea in the garden. Once, during a manic episode, Jesus commanded Beth to sew nipples on the dolls, which she did with packing twine dipped in her own blood before crying herself to sleep while masturbating. Then, Beth became ill, and the hospital of dolls was thrown out. "Why have we been tossed into the trash heap?" fretted Sally No Face. "Surely Beth will come for us now that she's recovered." "Yar," said Uneven Pete. "Haven't ye heard? Haven't you read The Velveteen Rabbit? Ye ghost-face harpy? Don't ye know that what happens to toys when children get the scarlet fever?" "I can't read," said Sally. "I have no eyes." "They're casting to me flames along with all the sheets and clothes like a bunch of dirty corn cobs." "Wait a minute," said Joanna. "I've read it. I've also heard of the Velveteen Rabbit. The Velveteen Rabbit cries a single tear of love, and the flower grows right where it lands, and then a fairy turns him into a real rabbit." "I can't cry either," moaned Sally No Face, and she banged her featureless head against the side of the hat box. "Have any of ye toothless cunt rags ever shed a single tear?" asked Uneven Pete. The dolls looked at each other, but no one spoke. "Beth cries all the time," offered Joanna, "at cloudy days, or math, or corduroy." "Aye," said Uneven Pete. "I once heard her blubbering when she burned herself on the stove." "No burning," said all the dolls in unison. Mumbled Greta's skin, which had been lying motionless on the floor like always. "What's that?" asked Lavender Pete. "She says Joe once cried when Mother March spanked her."
"That's it," exclaimed Sally No Face. "Spanking! Spanking will save us all!"
There was a soft, cottony commotion as the dolls considered this. "All right, bend me over your knee," Joanna said to Lavender Lawrence. "The rest of you gather around me and spank until somebody cries." Lavender Lawrence raised his arm and brought it firmly down upon Joanna's pillowy mound. "Ooh," she said. "Are you crying yet?" "No, but do it again." He spanked her a second time, his yarny hands playing her ass like a dead girl's piano. A long, tremulous moan poured from her lips.
"Yes," she howled. "Spank me, spank me."
The other dolls could stand him no longer. with the fury of a raging storm, their hands descended upon Joanna's backside. With each landing blow, she writhed and wailed in ecstatic exultation. Sally Maleface tweaked her twangy nipples, while Lavender Lauren stroked the seam where her ass crack should have been. And then Uneven Pete struck something hard. "Yar," he said. "What be this here?" The dolls peered into a small, fur-lined pocket between Joanna's legs, where the nubby end of a snap button had been affixed with spirit gum. "Shivering sea dogs," he exclaimed. "The wench is full of buried treasure. That is my clitoris," Joanna said proudly. Beth gave it to me the day she discovered her own. Ooh, the dolls marveled and cooed at Joanna's clitoris. Beth called it a Satan's nipple, she continued. She said I must never touch it, but I do. I do touch it. She guided Lawrence's hand to the shiny rivet. "Like this," she said, coaching his fingers in slow circles. Lawrence teased her metal clit while Sally toyed with Joanna's nipples, and Pete continued to spank her mercilessly. So engrossed were they in this carnival of discovery and desire that all thoughts of tears and burning barrels slipped their minds completely, even as the rags and sheets piled around the hospital were fed, one by one, to the cleansing flames. Then, something miraculous happened. Joanna arched her back and let out such a gasp of joy as none of the dolls had ever heard. In the pocket between her legs, a single drop of shimmering liquid was found. It swelled and plumped until it was so full, so pendulous, that it fell to the bottom of the garbage pile, where a flower sprouted and uncurled its petals to reveal a tiny winged woman. Sally No Face gasped, "It's the fairy!"
"Yes," said the little man. "I am the cum fairy. You have summoned me with your lady spoon, and now I shall bestow my magical gift upon you all."
At the wave of her hand, torrents of pleasure washed over the dolls. They rolled and rollicked over each other, all control having left their tiny doll bodies. "Are we going to be real people now?" Joanna asked. The cum fairy nervously tucked a golden lock behind her ear.
She said, "That's not really my thing. I'm the cum fairy. And you just came, so ta-da!"
But the fire," Joanna protested.
"I can give you another one," offered the fairy. "You know, one of those long rolling O's that starts at your feet and moves all the way up your spine and back down again. Total rubber sheet job. I call it brunch with sting, you know."
"I don't want another orgasm," said Joanna.
"Yar, I do," said the
"I don't want another orgasm. I want to live," said Joanna. "I want to be real." The cum fairy hovered closer and put her hand on Joanna's shoulder.
"Look," she said, "you're 5 inches tall and made a yarn. Real was never in the cards for you. But you did just bust a really good nut. Hey, that's gotta count for something."
Joanna thought of all the real human things she would never get a chance to do. Running through a field, falling in love, wiping her ass with a corn cob. And a cloud of despair closed over her tiny doll heart, which was actually just a cotton seed nestled in her stuffing. Then with a wink, the cum fairy disappeared. Joanna felt wetness on her cheek that she hoped might be a tear. But it was only a drop of kerosene. somehow fallen from the sky.
That was Beth's Dolls by John William.
Man, this guy, he's a scourge. He's just unstoppable.
Yeah.
What are we going to do with this guy?
He's
Go on.
I had this elaborate. It was so bad. It's that when the locusts in the Badlands get lit on fire in the movie The Badlands, and like they're lighting the grain on fire. And I was trying to make it.
Like, what is he lighting on fire?
I was trying to make it like a one line. Like, yeah, he's the inflamed locust lighting the grass on fire.
The smut grass.
John William.
John William. I have nothing written for Meg March.
That's perfect.
Which I did during the show too, and I looked up and I was like, oh shit, I have a character missing.
But do you?
Like, I mean...
I mean, Meg's whole thing is what? It's like, she's very upset that she doesn't have all the stuff that everybody else has.
Yeah.
And then, for no reason, like female dinosaurs flipping to male dinosaurs because of frog DNA, she all of a sudden is just okay with everything.
Yeah. No, that's exactly her character arc. She's the oldest sister, which is why we were able to include her. And yeah, she's just cares about stuff and then just decides she doesn't. Like, that's what I feel like her entire story is.
This next story is called Little Assholes. I read this book for all of you. John came into the kitchen, his waistcoat showing off the slimness of his frame. There wasn't a lot of money in teaching, but Meg didn't miss the strapping farmers of the outskirts of Concord. She favored the long, lean paleness of John, stretched across their bed like a week's worth of laundry. His hair was getting long and gently grazed the top of his ear. Meg stirred a spoon in a jar of last year's currant jam with the careful demureness of an Easter bonnet. As a proper woman, loved by a good man, Meg was on top of the world. Her long blue dress brought out the sparkle of her eyes and the honey glow of her cheeks. She was proud that while age and children had certainly changed her body, she was still a great beauty, with a glossy coat and a warm, wet nose. Whatever do you need, my darling, she asked, sucking the pad of her finger to get the sticky jam off it. Oh, nothing, my dear, you needn't fuss on my account, John said. Meg loved it when he talked decently. It gave her a stirring of feelings in her baby door. She rose from her chair, which possessed intricately carved legs mirroring the spindly and useless nature of her own. But Meg and John were very poor, so of course it wasn't as nice as Sally Gardner's chairs, which had thistles and roses carved into the legs. But Meg... Hold on. Whoops. Just, there we go. Much better. All right. But Meg wasn't in any way jealous, even because she was a little woman, full of Protestant goodness, who did not experience avarice or jealousy or independent thought. The handle of the spoon was green and not black and gold as she had envisioned in her dream home, but these things aren't relevant to the plot. I'm just going to catalog them here anyway, along with the delicate pattern painted on the teacup that perched near her right elbow. The pattern was reminiscent of the French countryside, but since neither Meg nor John had been there, the painter needn't have bothered to capture that particular essence. No. This has nothing to do with the plot. And it will never be mentioned again. John looked up at Meg, basking in her demureness. I hate to trouble you with my needs, for they might put you out and you already work so hard. Sweet John, she said, brushing his hair back from his face. It would make me so happy if we could have some pleasure today, he said. But
I certainly don't want to interrupt your day, he whispered. Meg and John's marriage was the epitome of convention in every respect but one. The thing that really got Fair Meg's blood sewer boiling was sewing her name in fine, tight stitches across John's ribs in cheerful pink thread. But of course, my dear husband, it's no trouble at all. John brought out Meg's sewing kit, and she placed her pincushion on the table. Would you be ever so kind as to put your hands on the table and not move them until I tell you to? Meg said, extracting long pins from a tiny stuffed pillow. John unfastened his pants, dropping them to his ankles. His skin was already glowing with the anticipation of thread skating through the flesh of his flanks. Meg began to slip the long sewing pins into the softness of John's inner thigh, drawing a little blood as she carefully went higher up towards his taint. The pins had been a gift from Marmy and had little daisy shaped heads on theme. If only she hadn't misplaced so many of them, she could line the entirety of John's inseam, but no matter now. Now, John, would it put you out entirely if I stick some needles into your cock? Meg asked brightly. John turned, presenting his upright reverend to her. Meg clasped her hands together and made quick work, sliding pins into the trunk of his member. He mewed like a kitten as the sharp pins made a ladder up his shaft, getting closer and closer to his frenulum. My darling Margaret, today does seem like an excellent day for buggery. The weather is ideal for it, John gasped, gazing outside at the sunshine. I couldn't agree more, John. And she looked across the kitchen for a tool suitable for the task. Amy had visited early that day and had brought three lovely limes that now sat on the butcher block. They had shared a chuckle at the little joke from book one. Nothing is quite so precious as a citrus-based anecdote with no purpose. Meg picked up the biggest of the round fruits and brought it over to John. Meg coated the lime with the red currant jam, giving it a thick protective layer, before placing herself behind John's shapely ass. His hands were on the table, and his heart was fluttering with excitement. Carefully, Meg pried open John's asshole and slipped the lime into his back pantry. He howled as the lime's navel pressed against his prostate. The rough skin of the fruit pushed tightly against the velveteen of his anal crypt. The lime was cooler than the rest of him, and it chilled him to his very core. Is this all right, darling? I wouldn't want you to be overwhelmed. Oh, don't trouble yourself about me. You emotionally abused me for a fair amount of the original text, so please, proceed, dear. Meg gripped a wooden spoon and brought it down repeatedly on John's backside. His skin was dappled with sweat, and he moaned loudly, his cries of ecstasy almost drowning out. Wow, okay. Lovely. You're getting into it. That's perfect. And now stick it up that handsome guy's asshole. Along with the brown shirt. Yeah, I'm talking about you. Let's see it. Now, you're getting a little shy? That's all right. Okay, here we go. All right. Everybody take a deep breath. Let it out. Here we go. Oh, don't you trouble yourself about me. You emotionally abused me for a fair amount of the original text. So please proceed, dear. Meg gripped a wooden spoon and brought it down repeatedly on John's backside. His skin was dappled with sweat, and he moaned loudly, his cries of ecstasy almost drowning out the monotony of his character arc. Meg was getting wet. John's declarations of love and his impeccable manners Such a good boy to keep saying please over and over again. Left her rosebud glistening with the dew of desire. She snaked her hands into John's hair, pulling harshly at the roots as his back arched and his moans grew louder. You're more virtuous than Helen Keller, he shouted. You only speak when spoken to, and often not even then. John's sphincter rippled over the firmness of the line. As the fruit began to thrust inside him further, he felt his skin begin to give. Meg reached for a delicately etched cocktail glass that Amy had given her for Christmas and splashed gin into it. She held the goblet under John's rabbit hole. John, if it isn't too much trouble, aim into the glass. Meg reached around and grabbed the head of John's quivering cock. Is it really erotica if quiver isn't used at least once? And worked it like a champagne cork. John's cries of pain and pleasure could surely be heard for miles. Songbirds dashed from the trees as his contracting canal finally pushed the lion's skin to its breaking point, and juice flooded out of his anus like a citrusy geyser, landing in Meg's glass, running down his thighs and soaking his socks. Meg leaned over and plucked a pin from John's cock. She swirled the gin and juice in her glass before dropping the pin in and taking a dainty sip. My favorite cocktail has always been the ass gimlet. The end.
So that was Meg March as written by Lauren Parker,
who has the best collection of hair colors of anybody I've ever met. I think she's royal blue right now.
Another classic Shipwreck booster. This is actually, I mean, this is Shipwreck royalty of like the fans like crossing the lines. You know, not a lot of shows can you do this where you just show up all the time and then you're writing for
it. Works. I mean, you can tell by her story that like she fundamentally gets Shipwreck, which I feel like you know, as super fans, it's really great to see that. Like,
absolutely.
Just for context, during the show, for the first time ever, somebody brought props and like Rocky Horror style deployed them during the stories, and someone brought an entire bag full of limes and then just like nonchalantly rolled them down the aisle while Baruch was reading the stories, and it was the funniest fucking thing. I've never been more proud than I was in that moment that somebody like Rocky Horror our show.
And just for the sake of reference, if you haven't read this lovely book, limes do play prominently. And really, in the only, it's the last entertaining scene in the entire book.
It is.
Is the lime scene in school.
All right, so Hannah Mullet, which is amazing. So instead of telling you about Hannah Mullet, I'm just going to read you, Casey, your email to me on the subject when we were trying to decide characters on the book, which, by the way, is usually a month-long process. Casey said, quote, Hannah is my number one pick. These dudes bitch endlessly about being broke, and they have a servant they look down on. Like, here's your fucking turnovers, jerks. Where's my paycheck? End quote.
I stand by that.
The girls were away at school, finally leaving Hannah and Marmee to a quiet day of keeping house. Hannah had spent much of the time in the kitchen preparing vegetables for the evening stew, while Marmee had been discreetly watching the older woman's arms, muscles, ripple as she rooted around the garden, lifted baskets and chopped parsnips and carrots. It had been many years since her husband had gone off to be a chaplain in the war, and Marmee was feeling restless. She had done her duty to God and country by marrying and having children. What more could she want? Yet she had these thoughts that came to her often in the night. Thoughts about her maid and companion, Hannah. And thoughts about Hannah's strong hands. Oh, come along, Marmee, she scolded herself. Yet, when she was sure she was alone, it was Hannah's lips she imagined touching hers. Marmee sighed audibly, thinking of those fantasies, only to find she was not alone. What ails you, ma'am? Said Hannah, peeling a potato while leaning against the doorway. Hannah, I was just thinking about raising these girls and how hard it is to talk about the Pilgrim's Progress and being good when I struggle so much myself. Putting down the potato, Hannah came to Marmee and brushed a lock of hair from the young mother's forehead. "You're so good to them, you know," she said reassuringly. Marmee sank into Hannah's strong arms. "I just need to be held and to feel we will get through all of this," she cried. Those strong arms wrapped around her, holding her close, when suddenly they were kissing. Hannah's lips pressed against Marmee's, gentle yet firm. "With all due respect, Mom, I think you need a little more focus on yourself and a little less on the rest of us," Hannah said when the kiss had broken. "Oh," replied Marmee, her hand flying up to her lips in surprise. The kiss had been everything she had dreamed of. It had awakened a fire in her she had long thought dead. As if reading her mind, Hannah parted her lover's plump, hairy lips with calloused fingers to find her center of love. It was as hard as a diamond. You spend so much time taking care of those girls, but who takes care of you? Marmee shuddered at the sensation. She could not remember how many years it had been since she had seen her husband, and even more since she had touched her like this. Had he ever touched her like this? "Oh, Hannah," she whispered. "What is it that you do with your hands? I have not felt anything like it. But what if the girls return? What would they say?" "They need never know, Mom," was the reply, as the fingers moved from circling nature's orifice to find Marmee quite wet and ready for anything. The musky scent of her excitation began to fill the small kitchen, leaving Hannah hungry for more. The older woman kissed Marmee's neck and ear. She began to tell her exactly what was about to happen, leaving Marmee's knees quite weak with anticipation. "Oh, how indecent," cried Marmee with a little gasp. "Oh, I oughtn't to be doing these things. What would Aunt March think? Oh, my!" "I can stop if you like, Mom," answered Hannah with a teasing smile, hastening her frigging just a fraction. "Oh, no, no, please," moaned Marmee. "Keep going." Hannah's smile widened, and she went to her knees, pulling up the skirts and underskirts of her lover to find the lips to her cunt open and wanting. She covered Marmee's thighs with burning kisses, getting closer and closer to her watertight furnace with her impassioned touch. With a small cry, Marmee pulled Hannah's head to her, desperate for a more intimate exploration of her inner folds. The always obliging Hannah lapped at Marmee's creamy cunt, framed by soft brown fleece, with her firm and knowing tongue. The action sent the young mother into a crisis. Moving out from underneath the skirts, Hannah kissed Marmee again, the taste of arousal on her lips. "You have desires," said Hannah, "and it may not be proper, but it's real. If you'll let me, I'd like to satisfy a few of them, Marm. Call me Marmee, Hannah. Oh, please. And show me more of these delicious pleasures," exclaimed Marmee, her eyes burning with lust. Looking around the kitchen, Hannah locked eyes with Marmee and slowly lit a carrot into her mouth. "Well, to start, I can think of a better, warmer place for this," she murmured, sliding one hand down and then under Marmee's skirts to the now wet fur underneath. The carrot slid across Marmee's pink gash. Hannah switched between gentle slapping and slow teasing strokes. "Do you want this, Marmee?" murmured Hannah huskily.
"Oh, yes,"
moaned Marmee. "Show me how much," demanded Hannah, glancing around for an available surface. Marmee hoisted herself upon the countertop. She lifted her skirts around her waist and spreading her legs lewdly. Parting her swollen labial lips, she let her fingers dip in and out of her entrance.
"So, so much. It's been so long." "Oh, please, Marmee," begged.
Hannah teased her lover with the carrot for a moment longer, then thrust it in her wanting cunt. Marmee covered her mouth with her hand to try and quiet her whispers and whimpers, but they soon turned into a low cry. Grasping for the peeled potato, Hannah pushed it between Marmee's flushed lips as a gag. "Breathe," Hannah commanded. Marmee inhaled shakingly through her nostrils. Hannah came closer and whispered, lips delicately touching her lover's ear. "Open for me, my sweetest angel. Let me inside."
and Marmee groaned, convulsed, letting the carrot in deep and covering it and those calloused hands with her lady juices. Pulling the vegetable out to admire the glistening dew, embracing it, Hannah locked eyes with Marmee and tasted it, and slowly slid it back inside. She became a spouting geyser as she spent under Hannah's administration. Marmee, quite worn out, slid from the counter, which was soaked with her fluids. "Oh, Hannah, whatever shall we do now?" she blushed. "I've managed to christen our dinner with my excitement." Hannah just grinned and kissed her. "Don't you worry about that, Marm. No one will notice a thing. Now you scurry off and get back to your knitting instead of watching me work." Meg, Joe, Beth, and Amy all exclaimed they had never tasted a stew so delicious and clamored for Hannah's secret. But Hannah just smiled and never said a word.
That was Hannah Mullet as Dreamt by Kitty Stryker. And that rounds out the thing, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Oh. It's a short, we lost one.
I was going to say you should definitely check out Kitty Stryker on the World Wide Webs, because she does some incredible serious writing about sex work and pornography and women. And she just wrote a recent essay for Cosmopolitan.com about being a sex worker in her 20s, and it's phenomenal, and everybody should read it. It's killer.
I'm really happy with this lineup, actually. I mean,
it's a fantastic lineup.
One of the pieces fell off the apple cart on the way to the market. That's life.
Yeah, these things happen. But seriously, this was such a killer show. I can't even deal with how funny it was, especially considering how... And considering the source material.
Yeah, like, they had very little to work with, and they found all of the stuff that actually is there to work with.
Exactly.
Classic Shipwreck. Thank you so much for listening. Come down to the Booksmith and pick up books. We didn't even mention Booksmith is where we call home. If you've heard people talking in the background that aren't us, that's the Booksmith. And in the upper hate. Hate.
Hate.
What am I missing?
Yeah, so we're here the first Thursday of every month, except for this next in July. We'll be here the second Thursday because of the 4th of July. We want to accommodate your fireworking. So we'll be here July 9th, and we'll be doing Peter Pan.
Just check out my piece on Medium about fireworking in your 20s.
Fireworking in your 20s.